Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, friends, and welcome to Dr. MC's Self-Care Cabaret Podcast. Do not adjust your settings. I may not be Dr. MC, but instead, podcast producer JC is here to help out introducing this episode. In case it wasn't obvious, Dr. MC is still under the weather, and in the interest of practicing what she preaches, she is taking time to rest. We did not want you to miss a new podcast episode, and hence, here I am. So let's get to what she would like to share with you today. Over the summer, Dr. MC conducted a series of Instagram live conversations with various experts, and they were too good not to share with her podcast listeners. Today, she will be sharing a conversation with Christy Harrison. Christy is an intuitive eating dietitian, host of the Food Psych and Rethinking Wellness podcast, and author of bestsellers The Wellness Trap and Anti-Diet. Christy and Dr. MC discuss the problematic pitfalls of the wellness industry, anti-fat bias, trauma recovery, and eating disorder recovery. Enjoy this conversation.
Hi friends, Dr. MC here. Hope all is well. Just jumping on here. I will be joined in a couple of minutes by Christy Harrison. I'm so excited to chat with. If you're not familiar with Christy's work, she is the host of the very popular Food Psych podcast, and she's also written two amazing books, Anti-Diet and her most recent one, The Wellness Trap. So if you're not familiar with Christy's work, you definitely should be familiar with her work. I was introduced to her really early on in my eating disorder recovery journey. About eight years ago, I was introduced to her work when I was began working with Anna Sweeney and been following her for a long time. So I'm so excited to chat with her. So she should be jumping on soon. See some comments. Yes, I'm in my new I Dream a Genie chair. The space that I'm in, which is my office space, I've been reimagining it to kind of have the vibe of Genie's bottle from the TV show I Dream a Genie. So I bought this awesome pink chair, which is super comfortable and sturdy. So shout out to TOV Furniture for that. And there's some other areas of the room you should follow along. I haven't revealed the full room yet because we're still working on it, but there's going to be doing new curtains on the other side and some other fun things. And I got to get my art up on the wall as well. So it definitely has the I Dream a Genie vintage vibe. We got some fun. Anyway, here we are. And I see that Christy just joined us, so she'll be requesting to come on and chat. I got my notes ready, and I'm so excited that you're taking a few moments out of your day. It's a little rainy here in the greater Boston area, so hopefully you're able to join me. And the screen has split. There we go. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Teresa. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just turn my volume up a little bit here. There we go. Don't mind my hand as I do that. Awesome. Thank you. This is such an honor. I've been following you for so many years. I worked with Anna Sweeney to kind of kick off eating disorder healing journey, shall we say, about 8 years ago. And she introduced me to your Food Psych podcast. And I think Anti-Diet came out a couple of years after that. And then, of course, Wellness Trap and all the amazing work you've been doing. So just thank you for that and for your time this morning. I really appreciate it. So let's dive in.
Great.
Do you want to tell folks like just a little bit about how you describe the work that you would do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wear many different hats. I'm an author. Like you said, I wrote the book Anti-Diet and The Wellness Trap. I'm a journalist. My first career was in journalism, and I have two podcasts now, Food Psych and Rethinking Wellness. And I'm also a dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor. And I like to say I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian because, you know, I don't put people on diets. I don't do kind of a lot of things that people think of as traditional dietetics practice. I work more on helping people heal their relationships with food, heal from disordered eating, reconnect with their bodies, and relearn intuitive eating. So yeah, it's just a little bit about me.
Yeah, that is a lot of hats and some important ones too. So thank you again. And I remember, you know, when I was first kind of starting the healing journey and working with Anna, and just really, I went to Anna with a very specific goal in mind. Basically, I was looking for the recipe for her to help me on how to be thin and just be done with it and be thin for the rest of my life. That's not what I got because that's not how it works. I didn't understand that then. And, you know, she's the one that really introduced me to intuitive eating and joyful movement and all of that, and really body acceptance and fat acceptance. And of course, that's been a journey, and I don't mean to diminish it or the ups and downs that have come since then. But yeah, definitely early on, a lot of your food psych episodes were very helpful too. So I didn't realize you had a second podcast now. I must have missed that one. So yeah, that's a lot. I manage one podcast on my own. So
I've actually recently stopped making new food psychs for the time being. I had kind of our final season, and then I transitioned into this new podcast, which is sort of picking up where we left off with food psych and delving more into some of the ideas in the new book. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah. So in your new book specifically, you talk a lot about, you know, all the pitfalls of the wellness industry, shall we say. Mm. So I work, in addition to my Dr. MC self-care cabaret work, where I help folks learn and understand what self-care really means and why it's so critical. I also am a administrator in a public day school. So how would you explain, let's say, to a 10-year-old, how, like, some of the pitfalls of the wellness industry?
Yeah, I think kind of the biggest overall pitfall is that it frames itself as helping people's well-being, and in fact, often detracts from it. You know, it often does the exact opposite of what it's claiming to do. So we see this with, you know, the diet culture aspect of wellness, certainly, where people are promised thinness, they're promised, you know, perfect eating and like digestive health through, you know, eating very specific ways. And of course, diets don't work. And people often end up totally getting mixed up in their relationship with food, feeling really disordered around food, getting into restrict binge cycling and all of that. And so that's one huge way that the wellness industry fails us. And then there are many other ways too. I think, you know, another one is that it sort of makes people more susceptible to misinformation and even disinformation, which is false information intentionally spread to deceive people. And so people get, you know, really caught up in things that don't have good scientific evidence behind them, that aren't really going to be helpful, but that are promised to be helpful. And, you know, I think we see a lot of this on social media. We see influencers who don't have any sort of credentials spreading wellness misinformation, talking about things maybe that worked for them, or maybe selling a supplement or a, you know, sort of working for a company behind the scenes and maybe not necessarily making that super clear, but, you know, saying that something really worked for them, helped them lose weight, helped them, you know, fix their health. And oftentimes that comes along with this sort of denigration of conventional medicine as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, conventional medicine is not perfect. I have multiple chronic illnesses myself. I've been through the ringer to get diagnosed with them, to get diagnosed with conditions and get help for them with conventional doctors. And I've seen so many providers who weren't empathetic, who weren't able to really figure out what was going on for me, who felt dismissive. So I know that there are a lot of problems in the conventional healthcare system, and that's, you know, I'm someone with privilege and insurance and access to care. And so for people with fewer privileges than that and in more marginalized identities, it becomes even harder to get quality care. You know, the weight stigma in medicine is totally rampant. And so I think people don't have a lot of great access to care, not to mention racism in conventional medicine and all of that. So, you know, I understand why people are attracted to alternatives and why people want to be able to take matters into their own hands and heal themselves. And then there's so much promise held out by the wellness industry and by wellness influencers and, you know, people who just aren't really credentialed to give information, telling people that they need to, you know, stop doing conventional treatments and follow this diet and that's going to fix all their problems. Mm. Or, you know, pay attention to your gut health, take these supplements, and that's going to get to that's the quote unquote root cause of everything else you're dealing with, right? And there simply isn't evidence to back that up or enough evidence. You know, in some cases, like with gut health, there's like very early stage research on, you know, potential dietary changes or supplements, but, you know, oftentimes that isn't borne out in larger scale studies. And oftentimes the supplement studies are funded by the supplement companies or people who have patents for a particular drug. And when, you know, studies are replicated, there just isn't found to be any good evidence behind these recommendations. So that's, you know, a huge piece of it too, is that the wellness industry is full of misinformation, of, you know, outright scams in some cases. And it's really preying on people's vulnerabilities and people's desire for quality care that they're often not getting in the conventional healthcare system. I know this is probably all way above a 10-year-old's head, so hopefully we don't have too many 10-year-olds watching this, but those are some of the broad areas I see as being problematic in wellness culture.
Yeah. No, there probably aren't any 10-year-olds watching it, but we would tell them that they're bullies and that they're liars.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, that's definitely, you know, was my experience. And even, you know, seeking help, once I had kind of realized that I really wasn't sure. I didn't understand how much of my rock bottom it kind of was into my eating disorder. I still thought there was, you know, something wrong with me and that, well, I just must not have cracked the code yet. But I did go to primary care physician. I saw the nurse practitioner. So somebody that, you know, you should trust. And this person, I confessed. I told them all the things I had been doing, all the really bad destructive behaviors. And the woman looked at me and she goes, "Oh, wow. And you still just can't lose the weight, huh?" And I was like, "What?" I think you missed it. And I'm like, "Oh my God." And then I could tell, I was like, "Okay, this is not going anywhere." And then she actually said, "Too bad there aren't like just a fat pill you could take." And mind you, I wasn't even like at this point, because I had been starving myself essentially. I really wasn't even that heavy. And, you know, by whatever standard. And she, I was just remember being like, "Oh, anything like that is my understanding. It's just like, it's really bad. I'm really just looking for a referral so I can work with this dietitian that I've heard is really cool. And like, can we just do this?" And then it ended up being a whole mess and I ended up changing PCP so I could get to somebody else. I just wanted to get to Anna because I knew that I had heard about her and I was like, "Oh, this seems like a more, a better path." But if I had listened to that woman, like I think back on that all the time, because they had recommended some other fat clinic they wanted me to go to. And like, who knows what that was. But like, I think that, and I'm like, what if I had listened to her? How many other people was she saying that to? And how many of those people listened to her and went that route?
Right. Which is why I think so few people get the help and care they need for eating disorders and disordered eating. It's just rampant. And yeah, it's so sad that primary care providers aren't more educated on eating disorders and don't understand, you know, the stuff that you were telling her. It's like, that deserves empathy and support and care and referrals and, you know, whatever else she could give, not like, "Oh man, well, you just couldn't lose the weight."
Right.
No, it's like,
what's wrong with you?
The opposite direction. Yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%. So, I mean, and like you, you know, I had been kind of a lifelong dieter for many years to kind of get to that point till things really spiraled out of control. Cause I find for me, at least anytime, like the new diet, you know, I gain the weight, gain a little bit more, then I was, okay, now time to start again. I tighten the screws a little bit more every time. It's like, nope, this one's going to work. This one's gonna work. Now we got it. It's this one. It's keto. It's this. It's that. So what's some advice that you might give to someone who is convinced that like this one will work? This is the one. We're gonna try this new diet.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I totally empathize with people in that position. I was in it myself many times too. And so I don't want to, you know, shame anyone for thinking diets are going to work or for wanting to try a diet. Right. Like there's so many sociological reasons why people are pressured into that. And I think it's really important to take the long view and sort of look at the whole trajectory of the diet. So the typical trajectory is that people lose a little bit of weight in the short term and then end up regaining it in the long term. And that's how diets work, right? It's like, you know, almost all diets, virtually every diet that is, you know, people could possibly go on is going to have that effect. Virtually all people who go on diets are going to have that experience where they might lose some weight in the short term or not. You know, a lot of people don't even lose weight on diets in the first place, but those who do, you know, you'll see some weight loss in the first 6 to 12 months, and then weight gain starts happening more and more rapidly over time. And so, you know, that's sort of what we need to keep in mind as we look at individual experiences with diets. You know, people might feel like, okay, this is working, but then like life gets in the way and, oh, I can't sustain it because it's my fault. I just don't have the willpower, or I have my life is too busy and there's too much going on. And so I wasn't able to stay on the diet, but if I had just stuck with it, if I had just kept going on this diet, I would have been, you know, lost the weight and kept it off forever, right? And that simply isn't true. You know, the idea that life gets in the way or that it's somehow your fault for not having enough willpower, you know, it might be true that life gets in the way in the sense that, like, you want to have more of a life than diets will allow you to have. But, and, you know, diets are not designed to work in the long term in that way. So there's always going to be something that comes in. And even for people who do stay on a diet, you know, and keep following the plan really strictly long term, oftentimes they'll still regain the weight, even doing the same things. And that is physiological. That's our body's way of protecting us. That's our body's way of ensuring our survival. And so, you know, when our bodies sense famine and restriction and too little energy coming in, there's a series of biological adaptations we have to make us regain the weight, to make us hungrier and less satisfied when we eat and think about food more and have more food seeking behaviors and, you know, be driven towards foods that are higher energy that are going to give us more bang for our buck. And so, you know, all of those things are kind of built into the human system, you know, for the vast majority of people. There are some people who have sort of more, you know, just restrictive type of eating disorders who don't really have those sort of biological adaptations. And that's another whole can of worms, right? For someone who starts a diet and then it begets more and more and more restriction and suddenly you're, you know, your diet is very limited, you're not getting enough to eat and you're having all kinds of other complications, right? So, so diets can spiral into anorexia for people. But oftentimes they will, you know, result in more like a binge eating or restrict binge cycling, or just even if it's not technically binging, it's like restrict rebound, where you're rebound eating to try to make up for all the food that you are missing. And that's really natural. And that's our body's way of protecting us. So to try to understand that and have compassion for that, that, you know, if and when that happens to you on this diet that you're really excited about, know that it's not your fault, that this is how diets, again, are really designed to work, even if they say otherwise, right? They try to convince us that it's our fault when we can't stick to the diet or when the diet stops working. But actually, this is, you know, what happens with virtually every diet. So you're not alone. There's nothing wrong with you if you can't stick to a diet. It's completely understandable.
It's so twisted, though, how we still feel, though, like we're the failure. Like we fail. We couldn't, you know, I don't know, keep it going or do sustain it long enough or whatever it is. And that's just, you know, society and fat phobia and all of that, like just making us feel like we're the failure. And it took a long time, at least in my experience, to kind of realize, no, I didn't fail. I did not fail. As a matter of fact, my body saved my life. Biology saved my life with my those things kicking in, and then all of a sudden it was harder to lose weight and I couldn't get below a certain point, and no matter how much I tightened the screws, it just, it backfired. Is kind of how I describe it from my own experience. And but then, and then the weight came on with a vengeance, and that was my body, in my opinion, probably saving itself, being like, what is happening? Like, we need food. Like, you've been starving me for too long and over exercising and doing all these other terrible things that we're not healthy. And like the amount of time, I think back, like to the amount of time that, and energy that I spent thinking about food. Like, I don't even know how I had time to like stress out about it so much. Like, it was so, so consuming. So yeah, I definitely empathize with anybody still struggling with that for sure.
Yeah. It takes away so much of your life, so much of your brain space, so much time, energy, money, happiness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And ultimately it just, it doesn't give you what it promises.
No, it doesn't.
Hey friends, we've got some exciting news for our podcast listeners. Are you ready to take self-care and body positivity to a whole new level? We're thrilled to announce the grand opening of the Self-Care Cabaret Shop. And here's what sets us apart. We are proudly size inclusive, and there are no additional fees for extended sizes because every body is beautiful. We've got a fantastic range of self-care and body love merchandise just waiting for you. From cozy sweatshirts and stylish tees to empowering accessories, perfect for showing off your confidence and self-love. So head on over to drmcselfcare.com/shop and grab your favorite items today. It's time to celebrate you. Cheers. Did you hear the news about our exciting new offering from the Self-Care Cabaret? We're calling it Talkback. If you're familiar with the theater space, you may have participated in a talkback before. After a performance, the cast and crew will come back on stage to chat with the audience and answer questions. Think of it as a casual, guided discussion. Inspired by this and by popular interest, we've come up with a talkback for the Self-Care Cabaret podcast. Groups will listen to a podcast episode or two of their choosing, then I'll come and lead your discussion either in person or virtually of those episodes, expanding on the big ideas. It's a great option for groups looking for short, impactful professional development, or smaller teams looking to get an introduction to self-care and well-being. We have done a few of these so far, and let me say, they have been so much fun. So if you're interested in bringing a talkback to your group or organization, email podcast@drmcselfcare.com. And now, on with the show.
So what might be, you know, maybe some signs for someone if they suspect maybe they're struggling with food or their relationship with food, what might be some early maybe warning signs for folks?
Yeah, so there's a number of warning signs. I think one is thinking about food constantly, you know, having thoughts of food that are intrusive throughout the day, even if you've just eaten, starting to think about your next meal or snack. Feeling hungry all the time, right? And that can take many forms. So, you know, one sign of hunger is constant thoughts of food. Another is, you know, fatigue, difficulty concentrating. There are things that are sort of, you know, feel more psychological that might seem on the surface to have nothing to do with hunger, but actually are signs of physiological hunger for many people. Headaches, nausea, those kinds of things are often signs of extreme hunger. Digestive issues, you know, sort of at the physiological level, people can start to have, you know, constant fatigue, difficulty with, you know, menstruation or hormones, like hormonal issues pop up, dry skin, dry hair, brittle, you know, breaking hair and nails, feeling cold all the time, you know, some of those signs of just not getting enough energy into your body, right, are often the case. And binge eating is another one, just even feeling out of control with food, even if it's not an objective binge, but a, you know, more of a subjective binge where you feel like you're eating past fullness, you're not able to stop, right? You're feeling out of control, especially around particular types of foods. Like I know for myself, when I was in my disordered eating days and eating disorder days, I would feel like, oh, I can't be around carbs because I'll just binge on them. I like have to restrict myself from them. And of course I would go to a party and, you know, there would be carbs there, and
right,
I'd stand near the table the entire night and, you know, couldn't stop eating it and would be like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? Well, nothing actually. It was my body's way of restoring the balance that it needed to have. I was restricting energy. I was restricting carbs. And, you know, when presented access to carbs, of course, my body was driving me towards that food. And that was a very common, very understandable reaction. So yeah, if you notice any of those signs and symptoms, I think that's a good, you know, red flag or warning sign that potentially you're dealing with some disordered eating. But I think a lot of people, you know, deep down at the fundamental level often know that something is not right in their relationship with food, whether it's, you know, I've tried so many diets and nothing's ever stuck and I'm just constantly banging my head against a wall with diets and I feel really bad about myself. I feel really guilty. I, you know, don't feel good about my body. I hate my body, right? Like those kinds of things are definitely signs to listen to. You know, if you recognize any of that in yourself, I think you deserve help for healing your relationship with food, whatever that may look like for you, even if it's not, you know, a clinical eating disorder. People all along the spectrum of disordered eating need and deserve help for recovery.
Yeah, for sure. And in a lot of my work also, I talk about like trauma sensitive for education, like how to create trauma sensitive classrooms and what it's like to work with folks that have been impacted by trauma and how to build resilience. And in my work, I talk a lot about how self-care actually helps you build resilience, which we know helps folks kind of overcome trauma. And we're talking about like real self-care, not like mani-pedis, so like the real, and expensive spa days, but like the real self-care that we have to do. And I always talk about intuitive eating and kind of, you know, some of that when we talk about the nutrition hydration domain. But I'm wondering, you know, how do you see kind of like the intersection of eating disorders and then recovery with resilience and kind of how that kind of plays in trauma and how that kind of what that through line is?
Yeah, I think one aspect of trauma, I'm someone with PTSD myself, so I've had a lot of experience personally with trauma recovery and done a little bit of, you know, investigating into the evidence. And what I found is really that trauma often disconnects us from our bodies, right? We're often not engaged with what's going on sort of below the neck. Like oftentimes we'll really live in our heads and not be connected to, you know, signs and symptoms coming from the body, like hunger and fullness cues, or like, you know, pain and chronic conditions that might be happening. And, you know, trying to get a handle on all that can feel really overwhelming too, when you're really disconnected from your body. So I think, you know, one way that intuitive eating and, you know, recovery from diet culture can be helpful and sort of an adjunct to trauma recovery, and I think helps, like, helps things build on itself too, is that it helps people reconnect to their body's cues in a specific way. You know, you kind of start out in this specific domain of hunger and fullness, but that can have ripple effects across all kinds of different, you know, physical sensations and cues, and also can have ripple effects into recognizing, like, okay, when I'm starting to reconnect with my hunger and fullness cues, it brings up a lot of emotions. You know, it can be really tough to heal from diet culture, to let go of dieting, to let go of this sense of hope that dieting might have given you, or the sense of distraction that it might have given you, right? That it can sort of distract sometimes from some of the deeper issues, and it can feel like it's a coping strategy for a lot of people, right? And it's a coping strategy for, you know, external oppression for some people as well, right? From the fat phobia that people face in society, in their families, you know, internally, externally. And so there's that piece of it too, right? Is like learning to cope with those external forms of oppression in ways, you know, obviously we need to change society to make that not happen in the first place, right? But also while we're doing that, while that's, you know, a long road ahead, individuals can have some self-care strategies to, you know, be resilient towards those things as well. But I think intuitive eating, you know, I've often had clients tell me, and I know this was my experience too, of feeling like once I started, you know, tapping into my intuition around food, I also started tapping into my intuition around other things about, you know, relationships and what feels, you know, safe and good versus what's triggering anxiety and sort of intuitively feels off. You know, I've found this in my like information literacy work too, that sort of tuning in intuitively to like what feels good and what feels like, oh, there's something just a little bit off here, and I'm getting this like, you know, subtle feeling that something's not right, that can be helpful to listen to. Not, you know, not that we need to do everything by intuition alone, because I think that would be problematic too, right? Trying to like heal yourself intuitively without any sort of medical support for conditions that you might need that for. And I think the, you know, maybe intuitive sense of like something isn't right here, I need to keep seeking out more help, I need to keep seeking more information, can sometimes lead you to actual care and support that is right, you know? And so listening to intuition in those ways, I think, is really valuable.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, you said it at the beginning when you were answering the question about just being disconnected from your body. That's a huge theme that I see in my work. And I'm always telling folks, like, you know, even simple things, like I always start my workshops, like, let's just take a second, kind of just be here. Just tell me how you feeling. Even just taking that moment to just maybe quickly scan your body to see, like, how am I feeling? Because we tend to just run from one thing to the next, and meeting to meeting, and choking down food, and or skipping meals, and just being so disconnected that a great self-care practice is just trying to reconnect and ground. And it can be as simple as just asking yourself how you're feeling or what you're doing. Or if you can take an extra minute or so and just kind of get quiet and just check in with your body to see what's going on. Are you feeling tense? Or are you hungry? Or you need to go to the bathroom? Are you thirsty? Like, even just stuff like that can make just a huge difference. You know, there's that misconception also around self-care that it has to be, you know, long and expensive and time consuming, and it's a luxury, and it's all these things. It's like, no, it can take like 2 seconds to check in with yourself, and that can be really powerful. So you mentioned, you know, your the sources and stuff and looking for information out. There's so much like misinformation out there. And so I'm wondering, how do you kind of personally, you know, vet the material that you're researching and kind of decide maybe some tips for folks to kind of watch out for when they're looking at different material?
Yeah. So one thing I do personally, and that, you know, people can do even if they don't have a huge scientific background, is like looking at PubMed, which is the repository, the U.S. government's repository for scientific information, scientific scholarly studies, and just, you know, seeing what's out there on a particular idea by filtering through like saying like only randomized controlled trials. Let me see what the randomized controlled trial data says about this particular case or particular question or whatever. Because the thing is, there's so much evidence out there that's like early preliminary evidence that is done in animals or cell cultures in a lab, or possibly, you know, when it gets a little bit further, there's like small groups of volunteers who are not randomized to receive a particular intervention, but they're just people who enrolled in a study and said, I'd like to get, you know, such and such supplement for Crohn's disease or whatever. And, you know, there's research done on those people. But those kinds of research really can't tell you much about clinical efficacy for a particular treatment, especially like animals and cell cultures. They're so different from humans, from what actually happens in the human body. And even the studies in the groups of people who volunteered for a type of treatment, those people are going to be very different than the kinds of people who didn't volunteer for the treatment. And so oftentimes there's a correlation causation confusion that happens there. And so knowing what's happening from randomized controlled trial data just shows you like, okay, for people who received a placebo versus people who received the treatment, what is the difference? And did the treatment have any significant effect above the placebo? I think that's just helpful to look at if you're considering any sort of treatment, you know, whether it's something that your doctor recommended or you saw on social media. Unfortunately, sometimes doctors will get caught up in hype these days now too, around a particular supplement or diet trend or something like that. Speaking of social media, I think one huge thing for, you know, keeping yourself out of the flow of misinformation is not to get health and wellness information from social media. And I realize the irony of saying that as we're on an Instagram live, right? I mean, certainly there's good starting points that you can find on social media. So you can find, you know, this is maybe a good jumping off point to look into more, you know, deeper sort of non-social media related work on the subject, you know, my books, for example, but not just my stuff, you know, Anna Sweeney, you mentioned, like other people in this anti-diet space. You know, you can sort of start to dig into their work a little bit more. But just getting information off of social media is really problematic because social media algorithms incentivize the most novel, the most extreme, the most controversial thing, because that's what keeps people clicking, spending time on the platforms, right, and therefore earning the platform's money, you know, and that's literally their business model. That's how they make their money. And so, you know, controversy really sells on social media platforms. And that's why we see influencers with these wild ideas becoming so popular. And I think it's really important to step away from that and sort of recognize the way that social media pushes us towards those extremes, and to say, okay, what does the evidence say, you know, separate from this, and not to get yourself caught up in something that's just, you know, somebody who's really charismatic, who doesn't have any sort of health credentials, but, you know, has an idea or says that something worked for them, can be very persuasive. But that's not good evidence, actually. That's, you know, anecdotal information is not the same as scientific evidence. And there's certainly value in lived experience and then, you know, listening to other people's experiences and learning from them and, you know, thinking about what could potentially work for you. But if someone's sole source of evidence for something is this worked for me, I would be very, very wary, because, you know, we really need better quality evidence than that to base our decisions on.
No, I kind of laugh sometimes. Like I'll see those influencers or whatnot or different things, and I'm like, "What are these credentials? What is this?" But whatever. And I always tell folks too, you know, make sure that your social media feeds, like, you're in control. So like, if you're seeing stuff that's not making you feel good, unsubscribe, unfollow, hide, block, whatever. Like, you don't need to see that. And like, even still, like, I've done a lot of cultivating of my feed on social media platforms. Every once in a while, like, these trash diet ads pop up, and I'm like, "Come on." I just report them. I'm sure Zuckerberg cares a whole lot, but I'm always like, nope, this is spam. Whatever, get this out of my face, because I don't want to see it, especially if it's on my feed. So before we wrap up, just curious, what's your favorite summer meal? So we're here. It's kind of rainy here where I am. I'm in the Boston area, but what's your favorite summer meal?
Yeah, I've been enjoying just everything on the grill lately. It's, you know, kind of changes day to day, but hot dogs, hamburgers, you know, the classics, and, you know, grilled veggies, grilled corn, all the things. I feel like that's, you know, to me, not having to cook indoors and being able to like take the heat of the kitchen outdoors and, you know, have something that's still hot and savory and delicious, but like that I didn't have to heat up my house making is really fun. And just grilling with friends and stuff is always fun. So
yeah, we like like to do that too. We have my husband and I, we have a little area of our yard, we call it the bistro, and that's where we can eat al fresco out there, and he's really good on the grill, and we've gotten pretty creative. We grilled pizzas before, that's fun. That's and all fun. Kinds of things, so that's fun. So yeah, it's definitely grilling season, so for sure.
Yeah,
thank you so much. I want to be respectful of your time. We've been on for about a half hour. I really just thank you for all the work you're doing and continue to do, and I very much appreciate you.
Thanks so much for listening to this special podcast episode from our Summer IG Live series. Dr. MC regularly goes live on Instagram to chat with other experts and amplify voices, so be sure to follow along at Dr. MC Self Care. You could also tell her that her step-in host did an amazing job with this episode, but I'm going to leave that to you. In case you missed it, Dr. MC has also been hosting virtual pop-up 30-minute dance parties called Dance Break with Dr. MC. Joyful movement for all bodies. A participant described it as the best kept secret in fitness. These happen at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Low impact movement, but high end fun. All bodies and abilities are welcome. Head to Dr. MC's IG bio to register or check out the link in the episode notes. See you next time. Maybe it'll be me. Maybe it'll be Dr. MC. Too soon to tell.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.